The topic tonight is the culture war. It's over. We lost. And why that may not be a bad thing. And as I was working on this talk a bit, I was realizing that my comments tonight will largely be talking about the culture war as interpreted through the issues that would have been important to what's been called the religious right. I know there is such a thing as the religious left, and I probably could have talked about the culture war from the perspective of the religious left and made real similar comments, but primarily focused on the culture war as it's been interpreted through the lens of the Christian right. And the reason that that is because that's a, first of all, a period of history that I've lived through and have been very much a part of. And part of my formative years as a Christian, from probably the period of the early 1970s up through when I graduated from seminary in the 80s, I mean, that was sort of prime culture war years. And those were my growing up years, and my nurturing of my Christian faith was born out during this time period. And I think probably for most of you, that most of you have come through some background of these issues, and so you'll be quite familiar with them. So let me begin by a time, and I think it was in the early 1980s, when I was at a conference of the Christian right. And I was in a room waiting for things. I was in a little side room, as I recall, waiting for things to begin, and people hadn't really showed up. And in comes, into this little room, where there was just maybe me and two other people, in comes the Reverend Jerry Falwell. And he comes up to me specifically, and he puts out his hand, and I shake his hand, and he says to me, "Who's this?" And I introduce myself, and for maybe 5 minutes, he sort of grilled me on, and you know, "Tell me about yourself." And I told him I was in Christian Missionary Alliance background, and that sparked the thing. "Well, you've probably read A.W. Tozer." And I said, "Yeah, I like Tozer." And we talked Tozer a little bit. And, you know, and then toward the end of the conversation, he said, and I'm maybe 20 years old, he said, "You know, we need guys like you." And then later on that evening, he gave a very rousing sermon that presented a vision of the Christian transformation of the society. America was in trouble. The Christian church was in trouble. The church needed to rise up, and the church needed to begin to influence all areas of life, and particularly politics. And he presented a grand vision of, you know, we're going to end abortion, and one day we're going to see Roe v. Wade overturned. And he presented this incredible vision. Of course, me as a young and idealistic Christian, I mean, this was very gripping and captivating to me. And so I tell you this, I'm a cultural warrior. I've picketed abortion clinics. I've been arrested. I was charged with disorderly conduct at a demonstration. Went before a judge, pled no contest, found guilty. I was very much involved in the elections of 1980 and 84, the election of President Reagan, and was very enthusiastic Reagan supporter, and was very much involved in. You know, I mean, Francis Schaeffer was a big influence in my life in the 80s, and very much influenced by his book, The Christian Manifesto, and very much activated to this mindset, this vision that secular humanism was ruining the country, and what was needed was an army of Christian young people to rise up and stand up against it and turn America back to what it used to be, a Christian nation. Okay? Now, if any of that sounds a little bit familiar, I mean, some of you, I suspect, came through some similar years and you heard similar things growing up. So I'd like to talk a little bit about that. And my general assessment that movement, if you want to call it, that Christian right movement is presently in a state of implosion, that In some ways, the death of Jerry Falwell in 2007 was a symbolic end of this movement, and some question of, as this movement seems to now be in a state of leaderless implosion, and some have marked it as dead, kind of thinking about the future. What does that mean, and how should we think about going forward? But let me first of all begin by doing a little history of the culture war. I suppose if we wanted to go back and think about the history of unbelief, you could try to think of a number of places. You might go back to the Enlightenment, or you could go back to the Greeks if you wanted to, and study the history of unbelief and the conflict between Christianity and unbelief. But I'd like to, just to keep it more relevant and current, I'd like to take us back to the 50s for just a bit and think about what life might have been like back in the 1950s. And by 50s, I'm really thinking not just that decade, but probably the time period between the end of World War II and, let's say, the Kennedy assassination in 1963 as a time period which we might think of as the 50s. And we're coming off the victory of World War II. America seems to have a sense of moral authority in the country, having resisted the Nazis in Imperial Japan. And during this time period, we see church membership doing pretty well. During a 10-year period in the 1950s, went from 7 million to 100 million. And you think about the culture of the 1950s, a number of the most prominent books, best-selling books, had Christian themes. I think of The Rogue or The Big Fisherman. 1953 alone, 6 of the top 8 best-selling books in nonfiction had Christian religious themes. You think of films that were some of the most popular films of the 1950s, portrayed Christian themes and Christians positive, like God was the good guy in these. You think of The Robe, I think of The Ten Commandments, Ben-Hur, Barabbas. These were major Hollywood productions with major Hollywood actors. So we've got, Victor Mature plays Samson. We have Charlton Heston as Moses. Gregory Peck plays King David. And even a young Joan Collins played Queen Esther. And these were major Hollywood productions. And, the biblical heroes and God was the good God in these and portrayed positively. From the period of the 1920s to the end of the 1950s, the theory of evolution was loosely taught in schools because it was still fairly controversial. You might recall there were even some parts of the country where the theory of evolution was banned to be taught, even in Tennessee up till 1967. And so evolution was soft-sold in public school textbooks. 1954, the term under God was added to the Pledge of Allegiance. 2 years later, In God We Trust became the national motto of the United States of America. 1952, Congress called for the president to proclaim an annual day of prayer. In the 1950s, prayer and regular Bible reading were regularly done in many public schools across the country. Some of you remember, go back and you remember that. So one journalist said the 1950s was a time when pot was a useful cooking utensil, crack used was the sound of a baseball hitting a bat, grass was something to be mowed rather than smoked, and corn grew on stalks in the Midwest rather than speeches during elections. And I don't want to suggest for a minute that the 50s were any kind of a golden period. I mean, you had problems in the 50s, right? You had institutionalized racism. And you did have a growing influential movement of unbelief, but largely staying up in intellectual and artistic circles. The general culture, though, would have had a sense of that, the Judeo-Christian ethic seemed to hold the central high ground, the moral high ground in the culture. You could talk about your love for God and country, and you wouldn't have been thought, brain dead and goofy or shallow. And if you just sort of compare that with how we are now, things have changed, haven't they? And so a lot of those changes occurred then in the 1960s. So let's think just real quickly about the 1960s. And again, not so much that decade, but say the period from the Kennedy assassination in 63 up through the mid-70s. Maybe you could think of the resignation of Nixon in 74 or the fall of Saigon in 75 as sort of the end of a period of an era of great change, great turmoil. And things like the centrality of Christianity started to be challenged. Early 1962 and 63, a couple of cases that begin to prohibit prayer and Bible teaching reading in the public school system. 1960, the birth control pill begins to, sort of the symbolic beginning of the sexual revolution, and sexual attitudes begin to change. 1963, Betty Friedan's book, The Feminine Mystique, the rise of feminism and the challenge of traditional male-female roles and relationships. Vietnam War that starts to, by 1968, starts to feel like it's going south and going bad, and public opinion turning against the Vietnam War begins to challenge the notion of America's moral authority. Student unrest challenges the establishment, which includes the establishment, the sort of Judeo-Christian establishment. And we could go on into the 70s with Roe v. Wade or the beginning of the homosexual revolution, Stonewall in New York, and the later 60s turning quite violent, more radical groups like the Weathermen and other groups that begin to speak of a revolution and peace-loving hippies kind of now becoming scary and Manson type, and so by the time and the Watergate and the fall of Saigon, and we lost a war, and there's kind of this great discouragement, and the storm now setting up for what we might call now the conservative counterpunch. Now a response that says, what has happened to America? What happened? And we've got to reverse this. Thus, now what we call the birth of the religious and Christian right. Things like the National Right to Life, which was formed in 1970, the Eagle Forum by Phyllis Schlafly, formed in 1972, Institute for Creation Research, 1972, again beginning the beginnings of a pretty radical counterpunch to the theory of evolution. Anita Bryant in 1977 begins the Save the Children movement down in Florida. And you might remember this was a movement that was countering some of the changes that made gays able to live more openly, and that was a counter challenge to some of those changes in the law. Concerned Women for America by Beverly LaHaye. 79, the moral majority, probably the most vocal voice by Jerry Falwell in 1979, and other groups, the Christian Coalition by Pat Robertson, the Christian Voice, the Christian Coalition for Traditional Values. These were all movements and organizations that if we could probably summarize the story or the theme that these movements were talking about was, America's in trouble. We've lost our Christian center, and we are collapsing into chaos. And Christians must rise up and retake the center and recover that centrality that's been lost. So it was sort of with this diagram here. This would have been this older mindset then that Christianity used to occupy the moral high ground in the society, in the culture. We could talk about whether that was ultimately ever really true or not, and Bob's talk was good about that. But this is sort of the paradigm would be Christianity used to be the dominant high ground, moral high ground, that's been lost. And we've been dethroned, we've been marginalized, and we need to get it back. Okay, that's sort of a dominant story and theme. And some of you are quite familiar with those voices. I think this movement gained a real sense of power and influence, particularly in the late 70s and early 80s. In 1979, Pat Robertson said, quote, we have enough votes to run the country. And also a 1979 quote, we, meaning Christians, we are going to take over. And there was some real sense of that Christians made a difference in the election of President Reagan, both in 80 and 84. During this time of now the 80s, we could think of evangelicalism did some growth during the 80s. It really was a strong time. This is the time when big churches start to form. I mean, when I was in Toledo, Ohio at this time, and thinking about it in the early and mid-70s, I was in one of the biggest churches in Toledo, and it was 500 people. That was mega church back in the early 70s. But you can think in the 80s, I mean, there's a sense of, you know, big power, and there's a sense of power with that, of look at these people, and look at these movements and these rallies, and there was a sense of a movement, and a sense of we can elect anyone that we desire, if we would just mobilize, because we're the moral majority. And it's in this time that I had my connection with Jerry Falwell. It was at the height, it was at the center of this, and I remember the feeling of sort of, this is a, boy, this, we're really going to make a difference and change things. It'd be my assessment, and you can think about this for yourself, that it seems to me that this movement underwent some waning in the 1990s. There were some good things that came out of this, and I think crisis pregnancy centers, you know, come out of this time period. And I think it did motivate a lot of Christians to have more social consciousness and think about the social implications of the gospel. These are good things. I think Christians did see that they had a place and a role in the public square. And I think during this time, the emphasis on Christian worldview became, you know, we need to think that Christianity is more than just narrow things, that it has something to say about all of life and God cares about all of life. I mean, this was good stuff. Some of this was good stuff that came out of this time period. But I think if you think about it, and if you ask the question, did this movement fulfill sort of what it promised? As you think about where we are now, in all honesty, I think you could make a case that the movement was a failure in some significant ways. Are we more Christian than we were back in the 70s? You know, is Christianity a more powerful cultural influence than it was back then? I realize there's probably some subjectivity to this, but you know, typically these surveys that come out, these Barna surveys, not very encouraging about the state of the church. Present a picture of a church that's actually lost ground. Actually, it has not been sort of church growth in many years. From just a statistical level. There's been a lot of church moving around. There's been movements of people moving from small churches to big churches and from rural churches to more urban or suburban churches. Those trends are very clear. But as far as actually statistical growth, church has not shown much, percentage-wise, not shown much. Yeah, I mean, you could think, how is the evangelical church perceived by the watching culture? Are we perceived as those ready to lead into the future? Or are we perceived as a throwback to some past that we don't want to go back to? Again, from the perception of the world. I think there's some reasons for this decline. Some reasons that come from outside the church, and then a couple of reasons that come from within the church. And let me just talk about those briefly. First of all, is the reality that America has simply become a more pluralistic nation since the 1950s. Okay, so during this time period that we've been talking about, 1950s to sort of the present, and the culture war that's been going on, another kind of more quiet thing has been occurring. In 1965, President Johnson signed the Immigration and Neutrality Act. Immigration and Nationality Act. And this radically changed immigration policy in the U.S. Prior to 1965, immigration policy going back to the 1920s gave preferential treatment to immigrants from Western and Northern Europe. So, for example, if you were an African or an Asian, it was very difficult for you to migrate into the United States during that time period. But in 1965, that gets wiped out, and immigration is much more level-handed. And so, during this time that we're talking about, we see people from all kinds of different, people from Asia, Africa, India, Vietnam, the Middle East, immigrants, Latinos being the largest group coming into the United States, who simply do not have the background of, our forefathers started a Christian nation and we've lost it and we need to get that nation back. They just don't come from that kind of a background, or that's not their narrative. It's not their story. So we should just, the reality of pluralism, that this sort of Christian centrality has been changed simply by the demographics of the country that have become more pluralistic. The other thing that's occurred since between the 1950s and sort of modern times, present times, would be postmodernism. The 1950s in some ways was the last generation of what we might consider more modernism, where American values were true, and true for everybody, and true. Postmodernism, with its strong emphasis on relativism and its strong sense of, that truth statements are social constructs by one group bent to impose power and authority over another group. So now you start talking about a Christian nation, and how that's interpreted through postmodernism is you want to impose your vision of truth on the rest of us as an assertion of power. And so that's not even seen as a good thing. That's seen through that lens and is actually seen as arrogant and narrow and coercive. So these are some things kind of going on during this very time period that start to make the idea of going back to a Christian nation very, very much of a more difficult thing to think about. A couple of another thing, I think 9/11 was a huge influence or a huge moment in America. In terms of that, one of the repercussions of that was that there was a strong suspicion of religion and politics, and people that were seen as sort of excessively religious were seen as threatening, and we certainly live in the wake of that, and there's a great sensitivity about that today in our culture, and you can think of the comparisons that are often made between, I remember hearing one guy describing the religious right as the American Taliban. And this is the kind of connection. You can see that connection then gets made, that religious fanaticism in the Middle East now gets transferred over into thinking that this is what, Christians are just the same thing. So that's a real formidable challenge, living in post 9/11 America. And then a couple of issues within the church. During the same time period of, let's say, the 1980s, when the religious right is really at its power and at its peak, what's going on, but you see that the sex scandals that go on within the church, and some of the big names of, you know, Swaggart and, you know, Jim Baker and others, and then the whole Catholic priest sex scandal that's been going. I mean, these were horrible. From the perspective of the public, there was some sense of the loss of moral authority in the church because of these high-profile sex scandals, and they weren't just the national ones, but I think we probably can all think of just sort of lots of local ones that in local communities that were undermining of the moral authority of the church. Also within the church during the same time period, you have the health, wealth, and prosperity gospel that also is making great strides in the church in the 1980s with its emphasis on technique to attain wealth and health, and a fundamental compromise going on during this very time period that we're talking about of the gospel itself. So that the church really starts to become in many ways worldly. The very evangelical church that's advocating taking over the world is becoming itself worldly and in many ways unchristian. You might think of Christian Smith, who's the professor at Notre Dame, saying that the religion of most Christians today is actually moralistic, therapeutic deism. So there's some sense of it, the centrality of the gospel begins to be compromised during this very, very time. Heresy. I mean, and some of our largest churches are really, really heretical. I mean, really do not preach the gospel. And that's really tragic. And often a perception then of the church as being very shallow. I think it was J.I. Packer that said the American Christianity is 3,000 miles wide and a quarter inch deep. And so probably some sense of perception that these people on the Trinity Broadcasting Network and sort of the public perception, these people are not ready to lead America. In fact, that's kind of a scary thought of these people leading America. Okay? And so here we are, and it's 2012, and again, I'm making the somewhat maybe radical claim, and maybe you'd want to disagree with me, but that this movement is now dead. I think it may be, that's maybe a little too dramatic. There may be pockets in America where it's stronger than others. But as a national movement, it has imploded, and usually those that have written and thought about this, both from Christian and non-Christian perspectives, I should note, have noted that the implosion seems to have occurred fairly recently, largely during the George W. Bush administration years. Again, think of probably post 9/11 up to the economic meltdown of 2008, somewhere in that period. This has become more and more evident. And thus the death of Jerry Falwell in 2007, I think, is a symbolic sense of this. So I guess let's just pause for a moment here and think, okay, we've just, you and I have come through 35 years or more of culture war, fighting the culture war. Some of us have fought the culture war and we've been engaged, and this is some of the time periods that we've lived through, and maybe it's time for a step back and some reflection and some thought about what God might be doing and what He might be teaching us and how we might, in a more better and healthy way, go forward. And so maybe it's time for us to question this paradigm here. We used to have the center. The center now has been taken from us. The center has been replaced by what we might think, I don't know, pluralism, relativism, whatever you want to call the center now. And that, you know, we need to get it back. That paradigm Well, again, I think some good things came out of that. Some bad things also were manifest during this. I think that this paradigm tended to create a very strong us versus them mindset with regard to the church and the world. Christians dealing with this, locked in this mindset, began to think of America as a battlefield rather than a mission field, if you kind of think about the difference in mentality there. This tended to produce a mindset of combat. Christians were people to be threatened by and people that we need to fight and resist. And so it tended to produce a sense of hypercriticalism, of negativity, of offendedness, of snobbery, of kind of, you know, nose turned up and eyes rolled at those non-Christians and what they were doing. A sense of that we've been victimized, we've been disenfranchised, and a sense of underlying resentment about that. And I would just suggest that I think these attitudes run pretty deep in a lot of evangelical circles. And they're not good attitude. They've not been helpful in the cause of Christ. I think another negative aspect about this sometimes is that it's come across, at least, as Christians desiring to assert power. And I mentioned this a little bit in my talk about the two kingdoms, that sometimes it tended to link too closely Christianity and, in the case of the religious right, the Republican Party. That they were seen as, you know, one, kind of one and the same. And good Christians were Republicans, and Republicans really, if they were really good Republicans, they'd be Christians. And that movement, so it tended to, on the downside of that, was a loss of the distinctive call of the Christian and what our source of power really is. And the Christian sort of thinking that the assertion of political power is what can advance the kingdom of God. And that, I think that took us into some dangerous places that compromised the church. And so I think that there's a new generation of Christians rising up that have grown weary of the culture war and are tired of the culture war and want to move beyond the culture war. I was looking at a recent George Barna statement here of why young Christians leave the church. Six reasons, according to his research, why it is young Christians leave the church. Reason one, churches seem overprotective. And it goes on to describe this a little bit, but this kind of the idea that the world is threatening, and the sense of overprotectiveness, and a few of the defining characteristics of today's teens and young adults is that they have unprecedented access to ideas and worldviews, as well as their consumption of popular culture. As Christians, they express the desire for their faith in Christ to connect with the world they live in. However, much of their experience of Christianity feels stifling, with fear-based orientation. So it goes on there, but the sense of the church being defensive and overprotective, I think that's culture. That's a culture war mentality. Secondly, teens and 20-somethings experience Christianity as being too shallow. We've talked about that already. Thirdly, that Christianity comes across as antagonistic to science. Okay. That's some culture war stuff. There's an embattled, the sense of embattlement. Young Christians, this is number four. Young Christians experience. Their church experience related to sexuality is often simplistic and judgmental. Find that, again, in a culture where sexual explicitness and is much more out there, a simplistic and judgmental attitude toward sex. Fifthly, they wrestle with the exclusive nature of Christianity. And this is again related to a kind of embattlement sense. And then finally, the church feels unfriendly to those who doubt. And I think, if you look at all six of those, there's, I think some of that is a result of our culture war mentality. Okay. So this paradigm, maybe it's time to rethink. And I'm going to conclude with maybe some rethinking of this paradigm. How about a new paradigm? You think about how we think of who we are in front of the culture. If we think of the church maybe from the perspective of 700 BC Israel, if you were living in 700 BC Israel, your mindset would be, we used to be a godly nation. God created us as a godly nation, but we have fallen into unbelief and lapsed into unbelief, and so we need to get our godly nation back or we're going to get destroyed. And so, your mindset then, if you look at Kings and Chronicles, we need to fight the Baal worshippers, right? We need to cleanse our society from, we need to get rid of these guys and get the society back to worshiping God. But I wonder if maybe a better paradigm for us today is to think of ourselves maybe more, let's go back even earlier to the time of Abraham. When he comes as now a believer into a completely pagan culture, and is called to live there as a faithful witness. So let's say, here's the pagan culture, and the believer is called to go into this pagan culture as a faithful witness and a faithful presence. So maybe one of the things that we could think about is, how about if we, as we go forward, maybe we need to think about giving up the Christian nation vision. That might be painful for some of us. But how about if we, just as a paradigm shift, give that up and say, we are not a Christian nation. We are living in post-Christian times. And we can grieve about that and be sad about that, but this is reality. We live in post-Christian times. But that our call, doesn't mean we get discouraged. Our call is to, as a faithful presence, faithful witness, knowing who we are and where our power comes from and where our hope lies, we identify ourselves Godward and through the gospel, and then as a faithful presence, step in and seek to be a good neighbor in our pagan culture. I mean, think about it. Martha was in Yemen, I know. Imagine a Christian in Yemen or some Muslim country who's going there, and maybe they're working as a doctor, a nurse, or something, some kind of public servant. Now, what does it mean to go as a Christian into that culture? I don't think you go in thinking, we're going to retake this culture, but you go in there as, I confess the situation, but I'm a Christian minority living in a non-Christian society. And now what does that mean? But I go in there as a faithful witness. I go in there as a doctor, perhaps. I go in and I change bedpans, and I wash feet, and I serve, and I seek to be a faithful presence and witness. And I'm sure often with great caution, in some sense, it takes real wisdom to know how to navigate that. But with a willingness to coexist with my non-believing neighbors, to love them, to not be cynical of them and think that my job is simply to be critical and offended by their unbelief, not with a sense of triumphalism or us versus them, but I step into that culture seeking to be a faithful witness with modest expectations. We ought to have a realistic mindset of what it means to Christianize a culture. That's a tall order. And that doesn't happen quickly or overnight, and it's transgenerational, and the church has been at it for 2,000 years and still has a long way to go in Christianizing the world. So we go with modest expectations, hopeful but modest expectations, that as I seek to be faithful in my vocation, wherever God's placed me as a faithful witness, again, without being critical, cynical, hateful, but as a humble servant, in the thought of, God, who knows how you might use me? And be okay with that, be content with that. And again, Abraham, I think, is a good example of a guy who lived among Sodom and Gomorrah. You see him in Genesis 15 or 14, actually engaging in a battle with a common enemy of Sodom and Gomorrah. And after he had actually won back a number of prisoners that were taken, who some of them were Sodomites and some were Gomorrahites, and a number of their goods. It's interesting. You actually see Abraham treating the citizens of Sodom and Gomorrah, again, as allies in some sense against a common enemy, with real respect. He gives them back the goods that had been taken by the earlier kings. He treats them with a kind of integrity and respect. But I suppose the more profound example is his intercession. In that number, how about if there's 30 righteous people, God, would you spare the city? You hear him pleading, don't destroy the city. How about for 20? Right, does he get it down? I think he gets it down to 10, doesn't he? Down to 10. Again, you hear him pleading for the city, pleading for the Sodomites and the Gomorrahites. And I always wonder why did he stop at 10? I mean, from what you know about God, let's just speculate a little bit. How about if he went down to 5? God, would you spare him for 5? What do you think? Was the limit somewhere between 10 and 5? How about 5? You think 5? You think he could have gotten God down to 5? I think he could have gotten. I think maybe he could have gotten down to 5. How about this? Let's get wild and crazy. How about, do you believe God is the kind of God who, because of one righteous man, would show mercy on Sodom and Gomorrah? Because of one righteous man. Now, that's the gospel, isn't it? And that's the hope that we hold out to Sodom and Gomorrah, that we know that kind of a God. I think culture war, I think it's over. I think we lost. But I also think that may not be such a bad thing, because maybe it gives us a new opportunity to, maybe in a more faithful way, in a more meaningful and significant way, think about how we might, in the future, go forward interacting in a increasingly non-Christian culture. Thank you.